Good evening from Lamar, Missouri, birthplace of Senator Harry S. Truman, Democratic candidate for Vice President of the United States. This little community of 3,000, county seat of Barton County, Missouri, tonight plays host to thousands of visitors gathered here from all parts of the country to witness the official ceremonies notifying Senator Truman of his nomination for Vice President. Senator Tom Connelly of Texas will deliver the notification address. Senator Truman will then deliver his speech of acceptance. This impressive ceremony is taking place directly in front of the Lamar Courthouse in the center of the public square. Many important public officials have come here from other states to take part in this gala event. Now, here's Senator Connelly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Truman, and this magnificent audience of thousands of Democrats from the cluster of states surrounding and composing Missouri. My countrymen, even amidst the stirring chapters of a globing, circling war, the United States must choose its leaders in November 1944. War does not and should not suspend the Constitution of our country. The National Convention of the Democratic Party, representing the Democrats of every state in the Union, nominated for President of the United States Franklin D. Roosevelt of New York, and for Vice President Harry S. Truman of Missouri. The vote was overwhelming and represents the choice of the Democrats of the nation. Senator Truman, we are commissioned by the Democratic Party officially to notify you of your selection as our candidate for Vice President. As an advisor and counselor to the president, the vice president sits at the cabinet table. He's contact between the executive and the Congress. Senator Truman, your party has selected you to perform these mighty functions. You possess the ability and character to discharge them with high distinction. No public office better equips one to serve as vice president than experience as a member of the Senate. And your years of service in that body admirably qualified you for its exalted duties. Your selection was prompted by your unblemished integrity and your rugged honesty and courage. During your service in the Senate, you acquired a national reputation for the service rendered to the country as chairman of the Truman War Investigating Committee. That committee gave constructive aid to the War and Navy Department and brought about correction in administration in the vast production program in which we have been so feverishly engaged. The dastardly and treacherous attack upon Pearl Harbor plunged us into the most staggering struggle of history. We have poured our resources of brave men and war materials onto the battlefields of the world. Our heroic fighting men have shed their blood. They have given their lives. Their bravery first halted and then overwhelmed the attacks of the enemy. Our triumphant banners in their gallant hands have marched onward and yet onward. The gloom of defeat enshrouds the Japanese Empire. Her military chieftains view with despair their impending doom. The enemy has been expelled from North Africa. Italy has collapsed. Unconquerable Russian armies are hammering at the walls of Prussia tonight. Our forces have swept through France and liberated her from Nazi tyranny. Our armies are sweeping on to victory. Under the leadership of Franklin D. Roosevelt as president. As president and commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, in cooperation with our allies, these triumphs have been won. They must go on. They must not pause until overwhelming victory is ours. The American people will not place in untried hands. The military and naval leadership upon which depends the survival of liberty throughout the world. The supreme tasks of this hour are, first, victory over our savage and cruel enemies. Second, the establishment of an international organization to preserve the peace of the world and to save America from being dragged into another war. These sublime tasks require the leadership of America. On the battlefields, we have given that leadership. We must give that leadership in the cause of peace. President Roosevelt, as commander-in-chief, has cooperated with and has the confidence of our allies in the march to victory. In the cause of peace, he is supplying our country and the world leadership no less distinguished. Triumph in war and triumph in peace are the demands of destiny for America. America must not shirk. She must not ignore the opportunities of the centuries to serve mankind. The American people will not recall, nor will they cashier the commander-in-chief on the field of battle. They will not summon the president away from the council table where with our allies is being erected a world organization to chain aggressors who would again plunge the earth in blood. War must be waged to victory. From blood-stained battlefields must arise a structure of lasting peace. To achieve these goals, the American people will elect Roosevelt and Truman in the November election.
Senator Connally, members of the Notification Committee, fellow colleagues of the Senate, members of the House of Representatives, and fellow citizens, I am deeply honored to have been named as the Democratic Party's candidate for Vice President of the United States, and I accept with humility and a prayer for guidance that I may perform honorably and well whatever tasks are laid before me. upon being nominated for the office of Vice President of the United States, my first wish was to express my appreciation to the membership of the Democratic Party. I have wanted since then to address my fellow Americans everywhere, regardless of party, so that I might make a statement about the critical times that lie ahead. Franklin Delano Roosevelt is my leader and commander-in-chief. In the past, I have supported the policies formulated by him to protect and advance the welfare of the nation. I will continue to do so and will continue my efforts to make certain that those policies are carried out promptly and efficiently by those entrusted with their administration. We have long been engaged in a desperate struggle to preserve our liberties and to safeguard the American way of life. Many of our brave citizens have given and are now giving their lives to win for us the certainty of victory now assured. All of us have toiled and sacrificed to win this most terrible of all wars. Victory is now in sight. Our courageous, well-trained, and completely equipped soldiers and sailors are beating down the enemy wherever he can be found. Their unequaled valor under the greatest leadership ever given a fighting force guarantees that victory. The task of the government has been to provide that leadership, as well as the foresight which will enable victory to be won as soon as possible. When victory is won, government must provide a return to that win, and our workers on the whole front assured that their sacrifices will not be in vain, that they will return to a country worth fighting for, that they will have an opportunity to earn a good living, and that the same humane principles and policies for the protection of the average man and woman carried out under Franklin D. Roosevelt for the past 12 years will continue under his leadership. Although victory may be close at hand, it must still be won. Our enemies are still numerous and well equipped. They have the advantage of fighting on the very threshold of their homes. We must transport our armed forces and their equipment and maintain them thousands of miles from our shores. Our enemies are fanatical and desperate. They chant hymns of hate. They utter threats that before they surrender, they will destroy the foundations of our very civilization, a civilization so painfully and slowly erected by the hard work of generations of mankind. The carrying out of plans already made to overwhelm the enemy and the formulation of new policies as the occasion demands require the coordination of all our resources and of all our people. The skill and ability of the military, of business, of labor, of agriculture must all be directed with initiative, with courage and with foresight and with experience, just as they have been since the emergency actually began. We know from the success of our efforts to date that under the continued leadership of President Roosevelt, those objectives will be accomplished. Under his leadership, we have met one crisis after another, in peace and in war. In each of these crises, we have had anxious moments when we faced the fearful possibilities of national disaster. No one can ever forget the prayerful moments that preceded our successes in Africa, in Italy, in France, in the Pacific. Those successes were possible because our fighting men had what they needed, where they needed it, and when they needed it. Much of the credit for this must be given to the wise decisions of the president. None but the most uninformed question the fact that Franklin Roosevelt did make those vital decisions, working with the great leaders of our war allies. Those decisions brought about the greatest succession of victories in the annals of warfare. Tomorrow's challenge is today's problem. Wise and proven leadership of our successes must continue. The fortunes of the future for which our boys have fought, bled, and died must not be endangered by entrusting them to inexperienced leadership. There's no substitute for experience. Experience which can be gained only through years of application and service. I am confident that the people of the United States, and I know that the people of my home state of Missouri, may be trusted in this vital hour to choose their president from a standpoint of proven experience and qualification. They will not choose for a president, by political chance, a man who lacks experience. In the struggle to rid the world of the enemies of democracy, the firing of the last shot on the battlefield marks but the beginning. Military victory over Germany is but a step. Military victory over Japan, though it may follow with all possible speed, will be but the completion of one turn in a long road. War has taught us that, whether we like it or not, we cannot build a wall of isolation around the United States. Our very existence depends upon the establishment and maintenance of a sound and just peace throughout the world. If you ask the historian why we failed to bring about a lasting peace after World War I, he will answer, a partisan struggle for political power. Let us remember the warning of Woodrow Wilson. He stressed that in an effort to make peace, partisan politics should be adjourned. Partisan politics, he said, and I quote, has no place in the subject we are now obliged to discuss and decide. His wisdom has been proven by the test of time. We have another historical parallel today. Make no mistake about the fact that once again we have among us a group of isolationists as determined, as bitter, and as dangerous as the band who set themselves against the League of Nations and gave to Wilson's peace in 1920 a stab in the back. Much work has been performed in the task of building for peace. The peace we seek is partly made. While the main task is yet ahead of us, world peace was actually in process of making many months, even years ago. The administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt was preparing the ground to support this peace structure when, against the bitter criticism and dire warnings of the isolationists and their press, Mr. Roosevelt first proposed Lend-Lease. This peace was in process many months ago, when two men met in Mid-Atlantic and drew up a charter, a set of principles for peace that have been cited and used as guides by both Democrat and Republican alike ever since they were first set forth. This peace was being made at Casablanca, at Moscow, at Quebec, at Cairo, at Tehran. It was being made last week in our own nation's capital. It'll be made in many other places, and at many other times. It is a continuing process, already years underway. Still years in prospect. We are, in our effort to make this peace, very definitely in midstream. And this peace has been given life, movement, and certainty by the high resolve of the men who are making it. Neither time nor space nor the personal hazards of a world at war have been allowed to interrupt it. The destruction that already has occurred and that which is reasonably certain to occur before the war finally is won will make this a most difficult task. The people of the earth will have to rebuild a new and greater prosperity from the ashes of the efforts of many generations that preceded them. The nations, great and small, must adjust themselves to these new conditions, must find a sane and sensible means of living together in friendship and with mutual advantage. We comprise but a small percentage of the people of the earth, and we shall have to guide the way with wise counsel and advice if we expect to play our full part in establishing a good and enduring peace. The end of hostilities may come suddenly. Decisions that will determine our future for years, even generations to come, will have to be made quickly. If they are made quickly and wisely by those who have had years of experience and the fullest opportunities to become well informed with respect to our national and international problems, we can have confidence that the next generation will not have to spill its blood to rectify our mistakes and failures. It takes time for anyone to familiarize himself with a new job. This is particularly true of the presidency of the United States, the most difficult and complex job in the world. Even in peacetime, it is well recognized that it takes a new president at least a year to learn the fundamentals of his job. We can expect any man without experience in national and international affairs readily to learn the views, the objectives, and the inner thoughts of those dominant leaders who have guided the destinies of our courageous allies. There will be no time to learn, and mistakes once made cannot be unmade. Our president has worked with these men during these trying years. He talks their language, the language of nations. He knows the reasons which govern their decisions. Just as he respects them and their opinions, so do they respect him. At no time in our history has a president possessed such knowledge of foreign leaders and their problems. None has ever so completely won their confidence and admiration. Winning the war and concluding the peace are only a part of the task facing us during the next 4 years. We must also reestablish our domestic economy. To win the war, we have shifted millions of workers, hundreds and thousands of miles from their old homes. We have built thousands of fine new factories and equipped them with tens of thousands of the best machine tools. We've increased enormously our facilities for manufacturing basic commodities. We have evolved new processes for shaping materials and new uses for those materials. We cannot go back to our pre-war status, for it is impossible to reshuffle our people into the old pattern. Nor can we throw into junk heaps $20 billion worth of new plants and equipment. Only by using them can we hope to provide good jobs for our brave fighting men when they return, and for our excellent war workers. With those plants, we shall make more and better goods. We shall combine full employment with an even higher standard of living. By utilizing new methods and processes discovered during the war, and by encouraging further research and invention, we shall ensure the position of the United States as a leader of world progress. The achievement of the goals the administration has set for the post-war nation will not be easy. Already, some selfish interests are complaining. If they can, they will prevent new independent enterprises from acquiring these plants, from hiring workmen, and from putting into civilian production a flood of consumer goods at prices within the reach of all. We must not accept the kind of thinking that during the 1920s kept Muscle Shoals and other World War plants idle. The administration proposes to see to it that these plants are sold or leased on fair terms to those who will use them to manufacture consumer goods and to create employment for our fighting men and our men and women war workers. If we devote the same ingenuity to production for peace in America that we have given to making engines of destruction in this war, our future will be assured. But to do this will require energy and courage. The forces of reaction and the selfishness of those who always fear any kind of change will have to be overcome. We cannot go back as we tried to do in 1920. We cannot stand still. We must go forward. On all these great issues, we know that President Roosevelt will take a progressive and courageous position because his past record of able and forthright action speaks for itself. As early as October the 5th, 1937, when few of us dreamed that war was approaching, Franklin Roosevelt, in his speech at Chicago, warned that the peace and freedom of 90% of the world's people were being jeopardized by the remaining 10%, who were threatening a breakdown of all international law and order. You need not be reminded that he was then called an alarmist and a warmonger by the isolationists and their press. The same group that now seeks to block every advance he makes for the welfare of the country. Despite strong opposition, he pushed through the National Defense Program. He steered a course toward preparedness. Through his efforts, we obtained selective service that enabled us to train a great army and to discover and supply its needs. Countless thousands of lives were saved by his foresight. He advocated land lease, which enabled the British and others to let contracts that gave us a full year's start on war production. He declared a national emergency that enabled our own defense program to make progress beyond anything ever before achieved in the history of the world. I need not recall to you the bitter violence of the opposition to these measures, nor the identity of those who opposed them. Franklin Roosevelt set production goals that were ridiculed as fantastic and misleading. For example, you remember his request in June 1940 for 40,000 planes? But under his leadership, those goals were attained and even surpassed. Industry, labor, and agriculture were coordinated and did cooperate to produce this inspired achievement. Without this kind of leadership and preparation, what would have been the fate of this nation? Who can tell how many more years would have been required to win the war, and at what greater cost in lives? On this greatest of all issues, the defense of the country, President Roosevelt was years ahead of his time, just as he was years ahead of his time when he fought for freedom from want and forced through protective legislation for labor, Social Security for the aged, work relief for the unemployed, and a farm program that saved the farmers. Just as he battled to protect the savings of small depositors and for security regulations to prevent a repetition of the financial excesses of the 20s that brought on the Depression. You remember the battles he fought to accomplish all this, and you know the sources of his opposition. His opponents are still the same. Which of these great programs are they willing to tell you they propose to destroy? These programs have stood the acid test of time, and the president's opponents dare not openly attack them. Ask yourselves whether you dare to entrust the further development and growth of these great social reforms to those who not only were without the ability to develop these programs, but who even lacked the foresight and the courage to support them. Ask yourselves whether you dare to entrust the negotiation of the peace of the world to those who are not familiar with world affairs. The welfare of this nation and its future, as well as the peace of the whole world, depends upon your decision on November the 7th. You can't afford to take a chance. You should endorse pride and experience leadership. You should re-elect Franklin D. Roosevelt, President of the United States. I thank you.